Just let it flow, she says. Welcome to episode 144 of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. Now, if I sound a little aggravated, it's because I did these ads 10 times in a row, and I realized that my elementary school teachers failed me because I cannot read. But this week, we have a very fun episode. But let's read the sponsors real quick before we get into it. Adirondack Brewery, located in Lake George, New York. Okay. Right in the heart of Lake George. They got a lot of different things going on. They got a paint and sip night in their bower room on Thursday, April 13th at 6 p.m. Tickets are $35. Include your first pint or a glass of wine. Or if you're like me, you have 11 pints and then paint and see what happens in the morning. So go go check that out on Facebook. Get some information. They got a new beer on tap called the Angry Vestibular. It's a Baltic Porter, 9.80 ABV and 30 IBUs. Now, angry vestibular basically comes from the term seasickness. Your vestibular system's a little bit angry. All right, so you see what they did there? Yeah, I know. And then they got trivia Thursday nights at 7 p.m. First place wins $25 off their bill and $25 gift card for future use. So, Adirondack Brewery, one of my favorites. Now, Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey, right off of exit 287, right off of 287. Big week in Demented because they just won Best Brewery in New Jersey by NJ.com. And how could you disagree with them? They got 16 taps. They got a beautiful tasting room. They got barrel program, sour program, awesome vibe going on there. They release beers every Sunday. Last Sunday, they released Litha, which is their all citra wheat. And then they're going to be releasing a pilot batch of brand new Lemon Drop IPA this Sunday. So forget Easter. Just go get the Lemon Drop IPA. No one likes Easter, okay? So Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex. And the third brewery that makes this podcast possible is Manskirt Brewing, located in Hackettstown. Go visit Joe Fisher and his Manskirt. They got the Highlands Hopped Up Pub Crawl on 422, and they're closed on Easter, but they got a My Back coming out, as well as their much-loved alt beer, Alt F4. Go check out the old bank building on Main Street. Do the brewery tour, but make sure you stop at Manskirt. Go show them some love. Now, Susan Robb. Okay, Susan Robb of Toronto is a speaker agent for six well-known speakers in North America and a brand ambassador to our good buddy Paul Templer. Her mission is to inspire others through her work as a speaking agent and client partner for the Center for Leadership Studies. Now, she's got a new speaker, Sanjay Nath. He started international business speaking when he was 19. He travels globally, talks about leadership, human performance. He also is the author of the 10-80-20 Principle. Go check out Sanjay. And also, if you need some information, you want an inspirational speaker, you want Coach Jim Johnson, you want Paul Templer, go email Susan at inspirepmc@gmail.com. Now, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Each week, Trivia Revolution has a bonus item. They got locations all over New Jersey. You can play trivia, bring your friends out, win prizes, and go check out Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. All right, this week in the podcast, we have some very interesting guests. First, we have Tony Wright. Oh, you know Tony Wright. No, you don't know Tony Wright, but you're going to get to know Tony Wright. He holds the record for sleep deprivation, 11 days plus. Okay, and it's just fascinating to hear him talk about, you know, the states of mind he goes in and what happened. Then, later on, we have this adorable couple from Canada, okay, that built their own island. They live on a self-sufficient island, Catherine King and Wayne Adams. Now, the audio is a little rough on them, on that one, but we're Skyping to an island in the middle of, British Columbia somewhere. So cut them a break. Guys, enjoy the podcast.
What up? This is Clay Rock One. You're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Oh. Been a week, but it feels longer for some reason. It feels like Victor Wooten was ages ago.
Yeah, I think it has something to do with this incredible weather change. Once you go from that, my just like, it feels like time goes slower and faster.
we've studied the body's changes during seasons for years now at this point. What exactly happens to the body as we shift from winter to spring?
Well, what happens is it all involves the pancreas. That's the most key part of the body.
The pancreas.
Yeah, that's the one.
Not the brain.
No. The pancreas controls the brain. It's one of those, the brain's the muscle, but the pancreas is the boss.
So the pancreas is actually all this time we've been thinking, studying the brain, psychologist has been
ridiculous.
Talking about the brain, and maybe the guest tonight has a lot to do with the brain, but you are here to set the record straight today on the show that the pancreas is the true head of the body.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it controls everything in the brain. The reason they don't see it is every time they operate on the pancreas, it's in a controlled temperature room. Now, if they did it in like a very hot place, like in the Mojave Desert, they would see the pancreas is just chugging and just
the pancreas
everything.
Is chugging.
Yeah.
What exactly is it chugging?
It's nutrients and red blood cells and bile,
now,
stuff like that.
Now, you know, but I don't know, so why don't you clear it up for me? Most people think the pancreas' job, its normal job that we know it does now, is what?
to pancreate.
to pancreate.
Yeah.
Right. Which means to create more pancreae.
Yeah.
Right.
Or as they say in French, la pancreate.
Yeah, that sounded very... very, very French.
Yeah.
Anyway, well,
I'm not a French expert. I'm a pancreas expert.
On
Scott.
Time, Obi barking because we're actually he's a little late. We were actually 2 minutes and 40 seconds into the podcast for his first bark.
Well, again, his pancreas is it's slowing down his internal time clock. He didn't know to bark yet. So
a dog's pancreases are you're also an expert on the dog pancreas.
If you're going to be an expert on a pancreas, you don't stop at humans, Scott. You go all around the animal.
Parakeet pancreas.
Those are the most fascinating.
Raccoon pancreas.
On the fact about the parrot pancreas.
Panda pancreas.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, okay, please continue, Dr. Pancreas.
Well, I was about to say, the parrot pancreas also controls the colors of its feathers.
You ever say a word, like, a bunch of times and start sounding weird? Like, I don't think I've said the word pancreas that many times in my life, never mind.
Well, you're welcome.
Well, I mean, it's just amazing how each week, almost it seems like weekly, we uncover some thing that you seem to be a...
We should do a bit, Need to Know with Berlew.
See, but then it becomes like a bit. I think it's more, we like your sporadic, you know, when you say something, you know, like that
so
all of a sudden I am able to
prepare for any of these conversations.
Something would come off disingenuous if we prepared for this.
That is probably
or true. Prepared for the podcast. That would be outrageous.
Berlew, you have a talking point?
But yes, welcome back to the show. Last week was a big one. Last week was good. Numbers were really good. Had Victor Wooten on for an hour. He, you know, I thought we were going to do like 15, 20 minutes. He just kept going and kept going. It was a pretty fantastic interview.
I bet halfway through his concert in Iowa, he's like, you people are boring. I'm going back to Verbal Shenanigans.
He's like...
he's just strumming the guitar. And
we had to get a guest like that and be like, listen, here's what I need you to do for me. Before your encore, you got to ask the audience, everybody in the audience to go subscribe to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast before I come out and have like a guy counting the subscriptions. You know,
yeah.
Not yet. No, everybody didn't do it yet.
No, I'm not in the mood yet. All right, another drum solo. Sorry.
But yeah, it is abnormally hot. Yeah. It wasn't as hot as I guess it's hotter than I thought it was. Because I've kind of been in and out all day. It took the dog swimming. he's a beast in the water now. He used to be like afraid of it. Now he's like, can't keep him out of it. So, but this weekend I you took headshots, right?
I've done headshots before. Yeah,
yeah. I took headshots with this guy Mike Salona. He's a comic, and he does like pretty cheap headshots for comics and whatnot. And I hate taking pictures to begin with. It's just that's an awkward experience. Like, I don't know, trying to make faces, but trying not to. Luckily, he's a comic, so it kind of like helped. Like, he wasn't taking it too seriously, but it was a little bit of a nerve wracking kind of thing. Like, and I got him back. They look pretty good, but, you know, you always look fat. You always feel like, you're, you know, like, this is a, I don't know. Did you find it like kind of hard to do?
Yeah, it just.
But now you should like, be an expert.
No,
you and your Izzy, girlfriend. Yeah. You got. She's probably outside the window taking pictures now, like making little hearts with her hands.
The FBI uses her to take pictures of certain occasions. Yeah,
surveillance has nothing on her.
Yeah,
yeah.
The whole Bin Laden thing. That was her.
That was Izzy.
She just went out. It was like a beach day. You know, let's take some photos and. She sent him out. It's like, who's that in the background?
But, yeah, did you, I don't know. I found it, like, kind of hard.
I found it weird. I was, like, in a studio, and they're like, oh, get crazy with him. I'm like, okay. And, ooh.
I know. Yeah.
What's a wacky pose?
Yeah, after, like, 4 points, like, to the camera, I'm like, what? Why am I pointing? Yeah. One, and two, like, is that all that, you got?
That's all I do on stage, you know? I have no act. I'm just like, hey.
Hey, like, Fonzie-esque. But,
I didn't forget you people in the back. Look at that.
It was quite interesting. But it wasn't as painful as I thought. But like all week, I was like, ugh, these headshots, you know, like, and then like, of course, I'm sweating immediately. I'm sweating like right now, just sitting here talking.
Oh, today's nasty. Yeah. None of my furniture is breathable. So like, you lean back for a little bit, and then all of a sudden, you.
I know. It's like too early to put the air. You don't want to put the air on yet. It's like, you know, I don't want to start paying for that. Yeah. But. It should be nice the rest of the next couple of weeks, but what time is it? 6:26. Yeah, the headshot thing.
Ask your pancreas what time it is.
The headshot thing reminded me of like when you're in elementary school and you got to take the photos and like tilt your head this way, tilt your head like look awkward, like I don't know.
It was nerve wracking for me because, like, every time I'd come home, my mom would be like, oh, how'd you smile? And I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. And then I do such, why'd you smile like that? Because I said cheese, and that's what happens when you do that.
See, I've never been able to do like a purposeful smile. Like
I'm terrible like that. That's why I barely took pictures half my life. And then yeah, Izzy was a culture shock.
I was always self-conscious of my smile. Like, I could never do it. Yeah. I have like a, you know, I think I had braces. I broke a bunch of teeth. I had underbite. And I just think I was always like, you know, like, I don't know, like not feeling great about it.
Yeah, do like the semi-grin and then somebody gets mad. Oh, that's not a real smile. Well, legal sense of the law, that's a smile.
There's smile law.
Yeah, but that's only in Portugal, and I haven't examined that yet.
Oh, we'll get into Portuguese smile law next week.
Oh, okay.
But
I'll prepare, but then you'll say, no, gotta cut it.
Yeah, do like a whole 20 minutes on Portuguese smile law.
Oh, okay. All right.
Start writing it. but I guess we should get to our first guest. We're getting close here. So you found this guy.
Yes, I did.
His name is Tony Wright. Which I'm sure there's like a lot of Tony Wrights out there. Probably like a bunch of athletes. I don't know why. I assume that's just an athlete's name. But
Who was the one we talked to before? And they're like, yeah, there's... It was a kayaker. It's like, yeah, there's a guy in England who might say.
Oh, Ben name. Brown.
Yeah.
Yeah, I imagine there are a lot of Ben Browns out there, too. But we still got to look up the porn star, Ben Brown. See
what, yeah.
But, so.
Maybe get a conference call between the two, see what they have in common.
Get both Ben Browns. are we calling Cornwall? I don't even know where Cornwall is. Penzance, Cornwall.
That's United Kingdom.
Yeah. So we're calling across the pond again?
Yeah.
All right.
We lucked out this week. Both of our guests are international, and both of them have Skype.
Yes. So if you are from Canada or anywhere outside of the U.S., outside the wall, you got to Skype me. My phone bill got demolished the 1 month, so that's the end of that.
Scott, I got this awesome guy in South Africa.
Well, and it also happened we had like three Canadians in a row. Like, what are the odds of that? But what is this guy? What's he do?
Tony Wright has the record for world sleep deprivation. He stayed up for a grand total of 266 continuous hours.
That's it.
And he's written some self-published books about it, talking about how it's mind over matter and how it's diet and how he feels that the human body can overcome some of these items. But
So you and him will have a nice half-hour combo about the pancreas, and I'm just going to sit back.
30 minutes only? Come on, man.
You can't cover the pancreas in 30 minutes.
Burrows in the pancreas, part four.
But let's give Tony a call. All right. Oh, yeah, now. Oh, yeah. Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Tony.
Yeah, that's right. Who's that? Is that Scott?
This is Scott, and this is Mike Burlow here.
Hey, Tony.
How are you doing?
Good, man. You're coming in nice and clear, actually.
Oh, excellent. That's good.
The last guy we had Skype in, he was from New Zealand, and it sounded like he was a kayaker. It sounded like he was going through the rapids. But thanks for giving us a few minutes, and welcome to the podcast here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Are you awake?
It's getting on here. It's about 11:30, but I'm still more or less awake.
So tell us a little bit about your background, because I've read over some of your stuff with your books, and obviously we contacted you about the world record, but what is your background in education?
It's nothing too sort of exciting, really. I sort of have a background in horticulture and plants and plant sciences from many years ago, 25 years ago, I think. And then I kind of got interested in human origins, you know, who we are, what we are. And that kind of moved towards, you know, our state of mind, our perception, all the rest of it. And it turned from a sort of a bit of an interest into an obsession. And 25 years later, here we are.
Now, Lodi, what do you do right now, like as a job or for a living? Are you an author, or do you have something that subsidizes your interests and your research?
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to get by doing what I do, which is an author, I guess. And I do presentations and talks, and I'm still sort of working towards finalizing my ideas. I guess it's still a work in progress, and. I think a lot of these journeys are often quite challenging. It's a case of trying to find the time and the sort of headspace, really, to do this kind of work, and at the same time find a way to survive in a world that's more and more about, you know, working God knows how many hours to make a few pounds.
Explain a little bit about what got you eventually to attempt the world record. And as I've read some parts of your book, it talks about how you've been theorizing about hormones and how it really changes the status of the mind and how we're not evolving. Can you kind of dive into that, and when did you decide to try to break the world record?
There's quite a few questions in there, but I got interested in this really through a series of accidents, I guess, and part of my interest came through hearing and reading about some of the ancient traditions, the sort of Arcadian mythology and the spiritual and religious traditions. And within that, amongst many other interesting things, in some traditions I came across this idea that if you didn't sleep, certainly reduced your sleep or even eliminated your sleep for a few days, it could take you to a much more interesting state of mind, and in fact it was implied a much better state of mind. And I guess that is a challenge to our modern preconceptions about sleep, that, you know, you need your 6 or 8 hours or everything pretty much goes to hell. So I began experimenting in the early 1990s with sleep deprivation as a means of changing my state of mind, and found it so fascinating that I spent 2 or 3 years spending a lot of time doing that. And that was, I guess, part of my experimental research. And I was doing a lot of reading around all sorts of areas. So when I finally came to I self-published a book initially, and I was kind of thinking, how could I publicize this? How could I get a little bit of interest, some local newspapers interested, something like that, or some radio stations? And just the idea of an endurance event involving sleep deprivation, simply because I'd had a lot of practice at it. I knew my way through it, and people, you know, generally seem to like that kind of endurance event. And so the idea was born, and after, you know, it took about a year to organize, and I was hoping to get a little bit of, as I say, local media interest, but it caught me by surprise. It took off quite a big way.
Now, you said you were gaining interest in sleep deprivation and what it does to the brain and your state of mind and whatnot. You said you were experimenting it or working your way. What kind of thing are you training? Or are you just literally like, you know, just seeing how long you could stay awake and then falling asleep? And what kinds of things were you doing to either extend the amount you were able to stay awake or to avoid sleep?
Well, the backdrop is I did change a number of things. I suppose, putting it in sort of modern parlance, it was really kind of like trying to run my consciousness system on my brain under different circumstances, tested in under different sort of environments and so on. And one of the things I did was I initially changed my diet quite significantly. That was way back in about 91, I think. And that did make some difference. I switched to what I call a more natural diet, just fairly sort of unprocessed natural foods. And then in combination, about 3 years later is when I started experimenting with sleep deprivation, and that, as I say, the idea was born initially out of skepticism. I found the idea quite bizarre, I guess, and a little challenging, but after some quite interesting early experiences, it became clear to me that at least subjectively you could get through the tiredness and feel remarkably good, actually, better than when, you know, when you normally sleep, plus a whole bunch of other strange things. And the challenge was to stay awake, so it wasn't just a case of kind of sitting around. You do have to plan the process, because part of your mind, part of your brain really does want to sleep. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure most of you and your listeners have been exhausted and almost do anything to get to sleep, but you can't.
They just put our podcast on. Yeah. They go right to bed.
Yeah, you may not make it through this interview, but continue.
I see. Well, I mean, you really do have to avoid sort of things that will tip you over the edge. So, watching TV is not a good idea. Reading's not a good idea. It's best really to be moderately active, and preferably have one or more people with you, just to avoid being caught out, I guess, because during some of that initial phase, it's very easy to not pay too much attention. Maybe you are feeling tired, you sit down just to sort of take a break for a minute, and then you wake up a few hours later feeling terrible, and you've got to start again. So it was just common sense, really. I mean, one of the obvious things is it's actually fairly difficult, not impossible, but fairly difficult to fall asleep standing up. And certainly putting your head down, where you're taking the weight off your head, again, you know, that's the normal process, and we don't think about it very much. But if you avoid those things, it's pretty difficult to go to sleep. So really just being moderately active, going for walks, cycling. I used to play quite a bit of pool, those kind of things. Anything just to keep a little bit active until the really intense tiredness remarkably began to fade. And, you know, this usually happened 2 or 3 days in, where you go through intense tiredness, and then it starts to break up, and you start getting periods where the tiredness starts to disappear altogether, and you start feeling good.
Now, what led you, what did you find out about the diet before you changed it that made you think, like, oh, this might help, or did you change your diet and then you noticed the help?
Yeah, it was more that way around. I didn't really have a firm kind of objective, and initially it wasn't tied in with any objectives around sleep. That came a little bit later. I guess I was sort of taking a snapshot of a lot of the ideas about who and what we are. You know, there's so many different disciplines and ideas. Mm-hmm. And having a little bit of a background in evolutionary theory, it occurred to me through information that I came across that we had massively, massively changed, kind of putting it in modern language again, the sort of basic construction materials, the basic fuels, and to some extent even the design of our whole physiology, particularly our brain. We changed those basic materials out of all recognition. It depends on your beliefs and your ideas and so on, but certainly Western science tends to support the idea that originally we were forest dwelling and subsisting on a diet provided by the forest, which biochemically is incredibly rich, really rich in chemistry. So that was one area I wanted to look at. It was trying to approximate or recreate some element of that very complex biochemistry and basically see what kind of a difference that would make, and then obviously start building in other things. So that was really the sort of idea. It was just trying to recreate what may have been something closer to our ancestral past, and whether that would affect how our systems work, and particularly how our mind works.
While you were going through this, were you trying to do any kind of experimenting or documenting going through the hours? Were you trying different activities just to see, okay, I'm more tired doing this versus doing that? Or was it just you were just trying to stay stable to kind of stay up for a long time and try to break the record?
Initially, it wasn't really about records. I was looking at where these traditions still had these kind of, I guess, ideas about limiting your sleep or eliminating sleep. So in a lot of traditions, for example, this prolonged meditation, which people focus on the meditation, but of course, incidentally, it's sleep deprivation as long as you're not falling asleep. And then I think some of the North American native traditions and South American traditions, they have this kind of vision quest approach where part of the discipline is to stay awake until you move into this more visual space. And it was also coming out of, I think, referenced in one of the earliest texts we know, the Epic of Gilgamesh, where this talk of the initiate sort of going on this traditional quest for knowledge and looking for the lost state of consciousness, I think, of the ancestors. And there were various tests and trials, and one of the final tests was to stay awake for 7 days and seven nights. So amongst all these clues, initially it was just a case of wanting to stay awake beyond the normal sort of patterns we all have. We sort of get tired. We don't really question it that much unless we're out partying or we've got young kids or whatever. We go to sleep, we wake up, and the same pattern goes on throughout our lives. So it was really wanting to break through that and see if there was anything different. And these clues, I guess, that I was gleaning from the literature, I sort of thought, well, somewhere between 3 and 7 days seems to be this window where interesting things might happen. So that was my initial target. And I guess a lot of it was quite chaotic and informal initially. Sometimes other people were involved, at least in terms of kind of offering me some support. But a lot of it was very subjective. It was a case of, being 4 or 5 days awake, and at times feeling absolutely amazing, a kind of sense of euphoria and a sense of actual awakeness more than I'd normally have. So clues like that, I guess, were sufficient to keep me interested and keep me really just doing these, repeating these experiments and noticing that over time it got easier and I became more familiar with the process. So I guess it was just a piece of the jigsaw at that time. And eventually, about 10 years later, it became the basis of this publicity sort of event that I have since still got a reputation for. But it was really only one piece of the whole picture. And as I say, this does crop up in a lot of these traditions. So I was really looking at all the pieces, looking at diet, looking at sleep, looking at the use of plant medicines and, biochemically modifying your brain, putting all these things on the table and say, well, what were they trying to do here? What was the point of this? What were these claims about these altered states and were they better? And I guess it was a an easy tool to use because currently there's no legislation against you, you know, not sleeping, I guess, as long as you're not driving a car or operating equipment, which is common sense. So you can kind of practice this ancient tradition, and it does have some pretty amazing effects.
Now, what is technically, like, if you're trying to do this, like, what is sleep? Like, is it a certain, you know, like when you close your eyes and you're out for a certain period of time? Is it like when you enter whatever it is, REM or whatnot? Or, like, is there a certain thing that categorizes sleep that you're trying to avoid? Or is it just, you know, like, or does someone, I don't know, someone watching you set this record that knows when you're sleeping? Like, how does that kind of work?
That's a good question, and I don't think the parameters were that solidly defined. It was never. I got in touch with Guinness, who, you know, verify a lot of crazy records, and about a year before, and they made it clear that they were no longer interested in those kind of records. They felt they were too dangerous. So really, it was set up to be as credible as possible with CCTV and people with me all the time, this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. The idea, I guess, was just not to lose consciousness, not right. to slip into a state where I clearly wasn't there anymore. It's not to say I didn't have windows of feeling tired for, you know, 20, 30 minutes at a time, but it was, you know, I guess having no obvious sleep. And any sleep I could have had was so minuscule that it wouldn't have made any difference over
right.
what was I think it was about 11 days altogether. But as I say, I had done a lot of this. I'd never done that length of time before. I think I'd done 7 or 8 days before. I'd never set out to break records. I was just, you know, experimenting. But during the event, it actually took place in a small bar in the far southwest of England, in Penzance, and it was quite a bizarre environment because, you know, quite significant periods of the day and night, the place was filled with people drinking and some quite drunk people there, and, you know, it was the kind of freak show going on, at least initially, till a lot more people got interested. So, you know, I was having to kind of deal with all that. It was live music as well. That was quite good, and there was a pool table there. So it was quite a surreal atmosphere, really, being in a bar for 11 days. I mean, some people might think that's a great idea, but after 2 or 3 days, it starts wearing a little bit thin.
Definitely. Let me ask you, let's talk about the states that you do get into when you're going through this sleep deprivation. I'm sure it's probably hard to describe in words, but what kind of states are you reaching? Like, can you give us kind of like a timeline? Like, okay, like day two, day three, like, and where you actually get towards that final 11 or whatever it is, how you're evolving both mentally and physically.
I can certainly try, and you're right, it is difficult to sort of put it into words sometimes. And it's partly based, or I've come to the conclusion, rightly or wrongly, that it's partly based on classic split brain, left brain, right brain, where basically right. one side of our brain, in my opinion, needs more sleep than the other side. But oddly enough, the side we're running on most of the time is the side that needs the most sleep. It kind of has weak batteries, and when the batteries run down, that's kind of when you feel tired. That's increasing desperation to sleep. So the idea with this process is really to kind of stay awake so long that the batteries in that normal sense of self are so weak and so exhausted that they kind of can't stay in control anymore. And you end up moving into this other sense of self where it seems like there's very little or no tiredness. And then the bits that get interesting, of course, are the other sort of traits that go with that. And they did vary, and it did change over time. I think the first thing I was surprised at was initially how relatively easy it was, windows of tiredness and these increasing gaps of just no tiredness at all, and feeling very relaxed and quite alert. You know, nothing profound there, but just unexpected, I guess. But with more experiments, more unusual things began to show up, and I guess I've already hinted at one of the kind of early experiences I had was quite intense, actually. I think I was lucky or unlucky, but it was a sort of experience that the kind of experience people talk about in, you know, kind of semi-mystical states or psychedelic states, right. Elements of that going on, where I'd been awake probably only for about 3 days, which in my experimental phase. It wasn't a particularly long time. And from what I can recall and what my friend also pieced together who was with me, after about 3 days, I had basically sat down in a comfortable chair. And from what we can sort of piece together, I probably had fallen asleep for between about 5 and 10 minutes. And I can still remember it. It's a little bit blurry now. This is going back to about 1995, I think. But I remember waking up. So I'd sat down in this chair, no intentions of falling asleep, but obviously pretty stupid thing to do when you're trying to stay awake. And I remember kind of waking up, but when I woke up, it was. It's very difficult to describe how radically different it was. Mm-hmm. While essentially in the same body and still in the same place. It's, I guess, a bit like becoming aware that you're dreaming or something like that, something quite unusual. And basically, I think what happened, again, with hindsight and a lot of experiments since, that I'd basically put one side of my brain to sleep. It's like my normal my normal sense of self had gone to sleep. And in the chaos of that sleep deprivation, something else came to life, almost like I was dreaming, except it was fully conscious, and there was that aura to it all. There was a kind of surreal feel to it. But it felt incredibly good. It started off as a mild euphoria, and very intense euphoria began to emerge. Believe it or not, I couldn't speak. I was aphasic. So I was kind of aware of that, and I didn't even have the typical verbal dialogue that most of us seem to have going on all the time, where we're explaining to ourselves stuff we already know. It's kind of weird, and we don't, you know, but most of us have that kind of voice going on like I'm doing now, but silently, and, oh, you know, not sort of in a way that anybody else could hear. That was gone. There was just this kind of sense of things and awareness, but in a way it's so difficult to describe because we're stuck with words, and that's what we always use, you know. In addition to that, I became aware that I appeared to be sort of partially paralyzed down one side of my body. It was like pins and needles all down the kind of the right side of my body, and like a heaviness. And I remember kind of looking at particularly my hand and my arm, and it was like looking at somebody else's limbs, even though I obviously wow, knew they were mine, geez. But it's like, well, you know, that's not really mine. And yet paradoxically, the left side of my body, and I remember quite distinctly using my left arm to signal, make hand signals to my friend. I was trying to explain to him, hand signals, and I don't know any hand signals, what the hell was going on. And my left hand and left arm, it was like super fluid, you know. It was like everything was on frictionless bearings. It just felt light, and you know, it was quite engaging just to move my hand around. That's how bizarre it felt, in a really good sort of way. So that was the start of an experience that I guess did put, you know, sort of shift me from being curious to being obsessed. And within, I guess, about 3 or 4 minutes of what was probably about 20 minutes altogether, at this point, I'm talking to you in words, but I wasn't verbalizing to myself, but I have a sort of knowledge of it somehow. I sort of recognized that, well, surely I must be able to communicate. I must be able to speak. And it was like learning to speak from scratch. I had no idea where the vocal cords were, didn't know how to make any sounds. But within maybe 30 seconds, and I had this sense of this kind of giant search engine. It's like, where is this damn thing? And I remember this sense of finding it, and I started making these kind of very basic sounds. And then the pitch got higher, and my friend described it, and I can remember it was like, initially it was like childlike gleeful sort of screeches, because I was in such a, I've said already, it was quite a euphoric state. So it was a very, very intense state, very happy state. And literally maybe 5-10 seconds later, I suddenly had it. I knew how to work this thing, and I could speak. And again, strangely enough, the friend I was with had known me long enough to know my, you know, my sort of normal voice, the voice I'm using now. But the voice that came out of me was quite distinct. The sound was different. It was more resonant. It had a more relaxed sort of pitch. And the syntax was already different. It was automatically sort of more poetic, not in the way I normally speak or would even know how to speak unless I really give it some thought. It made perfect sense, but a lot of the sort of verbs and adjectives were reversed and so on. So there was, my friend was obviously quite perplexed by all this, because here's this crazy friend of his doing this weird experiment, and then he sort of opens his eyes and he's like speaking with a different voice. That's kind of pretty scary, I guess. But I was trying to signal to him prior to this that everything was okay, and then I found this voice, and I tried to explain as best I could in this different voice that I felt the normal in charge. Normal version of me was sound asleep, and I even had a sense that I had to, I was speaking quite quietly to him. I had a sense that I had to keep everything quite quiet for this situation to continue for the brief time it did. So it probably all sounds quite strange, and it was very strange, but overall the experience was profound. It was quite an amazing experience, and during the whole 20 minutes or so, it was like something that I'd never really accessed before was spinning up for the first time, and it really just reached this, this amazing sort of pitch of intensity, and it was, I guess, like peering into a whole new cosmos that you'd never seen before, and yet somehow you know it's part of yourself.
Interesting.
My nights at the bar are very similar, for other reasons.
Can't feel your limbs.
No, officer, I can't drive. What are you talking about? I'm out of euphoria.
My left brain's sober. My right brain's...
So there almost certainly are parallels with chemically altered states. I've done a lot of experiments since and in combination with, and alcohol, not so much. It tends to shut things down, but other things do have some parallel effects. And again, the fact that these things crop up in these ancient approaches was part of what was fueling my curiosity. What were these people up to? Why were they doing these weird things? And the idea that came out of it was, and it's in these traditions that actually in our distant past we had a much more functional state and a very different state. And we've kind of lost touch with it, and we barely glimpse it now if we're lucky. And the state that we think is normal is incredibly mundane and limited. But of course, we don't have any other reference points, so that's how we judge. That's how we judge ourselves and pretty much everyone else. It's most of us. We wake up in the morning, we think, yeah, well, things are okay, but we just don't have any other reference points unless we've had what are termed kind of peak or high experiences. And I think these traditions were on about a state that was like that all the time. So that's really what I think I was starting to look for, was, is there something real in this? Is it possible to access it? And some of these approaches might sound bizarre, but when you look at the modern neurology, they kind of start to make a little bit of sense once you accept the possibility that we might just have it all back to front.
And when you got to the 11th day, when did you decide, okay, I'm done with this? Was it more how you were feeling, or just in a sense, I'm done with this experiment?
Right,
or
okay.
Or did you just collapse?
It wasn't as difficult as I thought it was going to be. As I say, it was new territory for me. I think I remember getting to about, well, first of all, I had a specific target in mind, to be quite clear. In doing my research, I was aware that there were various records. There's also weird medical conditions where people don't sleep, and so on and so forth. So I was really just looking at the sort of mainstream idea of a sleep deprivation record. It wasn't necessarily going to stand up to a lot of scientific scrutiny. But there was a guy, I think, in the year I was born, which, it was just looking for a hook, really, a chap called Randy Gardner, who was 17 at the time, and he... if I remember correctly, I think there was some science fair on. He's based in the States, or he lived in the States. And as part of his experimental approach or whatever he's doing, I guess he was at school or college, he wanted to break the world record as it was at that time, which was 11 days, or maybe it was just under 11 days, because he did 11 days. So remember, he's 17 at the time. I was about 43 or 44 or something. And I chose that record because there's still a fair amount of documentation, and some of it's online now, sort of reading accounts of how difficult he found it, and that from about day two, he almost had to have his friends sort of drag him around the place to keep him, semi-conscious. And I knew from my own experience, I thought, well, I won't find it that difficult, you know, whether it's a combination of diet and practice. I will have some tiredness, but for the most part, you know, I'll get through this a lot easier. So I set myself up to break his record, which was exactly 11 days. So I obviously just had to go, you know, a minute past 11 days. So I think I ended up doing, it was about 11 days and 2 hours officially, and then I'd actually been up before the record started doing some interviews, that kind of thing. So I had a deadline in mind, and once that came, I have to admit, once that kind of record had passed and I wasn't so focused anymore on not getting comfortable, I ended up just I did end up just falling asleep a few times, even mid-interview and stuff, because I just no longer had any kind of interest, really. And I found the whole process absolutely fascinating, but quite intimidating, because I never expected it to be anything like as, you know, media friendly as it was. I had, you know, camera crews turning up and the phone was ringing off the hook and stuff. So it was quite an intense process. And in some ways that helped keep me awake. You know, there was always somebody on the phone wanting to speak to me and so on.
Interesting. Now, let me ask you something. Like, you're talking about these altered states and, you know, hallucinogenic. And so, like, the more you hear, you know, you watch shows and listen to podcasts, you hear about, like, medicinal use of, like, DMT and people doing, like, float tanks and experimenting with mushrooms and things like that that are, you know, apparently beneficial, and people are talking about, like, confronting things like that. Do you find that you find that same, I don't know, feeling or same result with the sleep deprivation, or do you find those two totally different things?
I'd say they're related. There is some crossover. There are some parallels. They're not exactly the same, but I suppose, again, going back to what I mentioned earlier and what I've based, you know, after all these years, I've kind of pieced together a theory, and I've tried to use, you know, modern language, scientific language, and so on. Uh-huh. So going back to this split brain idea, essentially what I've proposed is that half our brain, at least half the modern part of our brain, the new part of our brain, is now pretty screwed. It's, you know, and it's not very functional, and it's pretty stupid, but that's who we are most of the time, and we highly defend that. That's the last thing we want to admit to, you know, how frightened we are, how bloody crazy we are. And we all know the rules, and we, you know, we all know what to say and not to say and so on, and we all kind of play this game, pretend everything's kind of okay when clearly everything's going to shit, you know. There's not any mystery there. So the idea, I think, was that these ancient traditions, they knew there was something going amiss. Basically humans were in trouble, and they came up with these ingenious approaches to try and switch us out of this part of our brain that was degenerating, was becoming less and less functional, and trying to move us into the side of our brain that still had some semblance of sanity. So I guess that was really the sort of agenda behind all this, trying to see if there was some truth to that. And of course, along the way, finding many different approaches that come to the same conclusion. And I think the difference between sleep deprivation and the use of plant medicines, psychedelics, and so on, is the sleep deprivation, I think, was intended to run the batteries down of the normal ego day-to-day self to the point where it just can't get in the way. It can't stop this otherness coming through. And yeah, I think there are clues. For example, we tend to socialize in the evening when we're a bit tired. We tend to feel more emotions when we're a bit tired. It's basically that kind of, you know, the prison guard is tired and it's napping and things are sneaking out, you know, they're breaking out of this kind of basement prison where this otherness lives. And then you've got the psychedelics, the plant medicines, and they, I think, they asymmetrically stimulate the brain. They tend to stimulate that side of the brain that's normally dormant and locked away. So it kind of wakes up a little bit or a lot, depending on, you know, how often you do that or what you... What approaches you use. I think there is a crossover. One approach is inhibiting the side of our brain that stops us feeling these things, and the other approach is trying to stimulate the side of the brain that can feel these things. And of course, pretty obviously, you put those two things together, which they did in these ancient traditions, they had it nailed with things, you know, the ancient idea of trance dance, where you're moving, you're staying awake for 2, 3, 4 days at a time, probably taking various libations, including, you know, God knows what, mushroom tea or something. And, you know, they were having a pretty intense experience, and it was probably pretty damn good.
Yeah. So let me ask you, like, on a normal day, like, what do you sleep now? Like, your average day?
It's sleep over time became a partial option, I guess, not entirely, you know. I've not really been interested, not found a way to not sleep at all, but certainly the option of not sleeping for sort of 3 to 5 days was certainly quite doable. But I suppose the truth is it's quite challenging to maintain that when you're in the midst of a sort of fairly normal life. If you've got kids to look after, or you've got to get to A to B in a car, or this kind of thing. So unless I'm in what I call more experimental mode, you know, I sleep sort of 4 to 6 hours. There's a price to pay. You know, and a lot of people notice this. You know, we sleep, we think, well, sleep's great, it's what we need. And yet most of us, or a lot of us, wake up feeling actually pretty groggy initially and not very coherent at all. And that's certainly something, you know, I'm very aware of, that when I sleep, some part of me is benefiting from that, and it's in charge when I wake up. But it's quite heavy. It's not very fluid. It's quite deadpan, really. So I sleep fairly normally, or maybe a bit less than average, when I'm, you know, engaged in fairly normal life. But I can certainly still not sleep, and within a day or two, it all starts lighting up again. And it's always a fascinating process.
When you do these experiments, do you dream? And if so, is it more intense considering how much the right side of the brain is dominating at that time, and that's the creative side?
Yeah, I think the short answer is yes. I noticed quite early on that staying awake for 2, 3 days or more, it was very easy to move from being apparently awake and being with people and knowing you are awake, what, you know, as certain as you can be about anything, and moving quite seamlessly into a semi-conscious state where incredibly vivid dreams. So you might be, I don't know, sat around a table with some people, and you maybe, I don't know, have this idea about something, and the idea is very intense visual. Next thing, it's you know, panoramic, and you're off almost flying through the sky or whatever. It's, you know, super intense dreams, and they can creep up on you. So yeah, very, very intense, and more intense than normal reality. That's how they can seem. And then more intriguingly than that, I think relics of, you know, I've only knowingly sleptwalked once in my life. It was probably about 14 or 15 or maybe a bit younger. And I remember, we lived in a bungalow, and I remember going to bed, and I woke up on the front lawn. No idea how I got there.
Jeez.
And looked up, and initially I thought it was sunny. It was actually full moon, but I just, you know, the brightness of the moon, and my feet were cold because the grass had a lot of dew on it. And I was a bit perplexed and even a little bit frightened, and I had no recollection initially how I got there. So I kind of walked around, I got around the back of the house, climbed back in my bedroom, and went back to bed quite worried about the whole thing. But then, interestingly, the next night, I think I got up to go to the loo, and it was still pretty much full moon, and there was lots of shadows cast through the house, and that reminded me of a dream I had the night before, or so I thought it was a dream. And in my dream, I was being pursued, you know, typical teenage dream, probably. I was trying to get away from some people. And I remember running out of my bedroom through the dining room and climbing out of the window, jumping over the flower beds, and then running across the lawn, which is exactly what happened. Now, I'm saying this because I had a parallel experience many years later when I was doing these experiments, where I actually managed to persuade a university to do some monitoring when I was sleep deprived. And I was probably about 4 or 5 days in, and I was walking from the town back to the campus. And as I was walking along on the pavement, I knew I was starting to move into a sort of half and half state. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm out here on my own, away from the campus. This isn't a good idea. You know, it's a public space. I'm not quite sure what's going to happen. And then, to put it in, you know, chronologically, next thing I was dreaming, I was in this driveway and there was a car. And in my dream state, I had this idea that, oh, you know, I'll just see what's inside the car. It might remind me of where I am, because I didn't know where I was. And so I'm sort of peering through the window of this car on somebody's drive and kind of slowly came out of the dream. And of course, it wasn't a dream at all. I had walked into somebody's drive and I was peering into the car window.
Jeez.
So again, quite bizarre, but a lot of clues in there. That was fascinating. It's like we do have this other self, and normally it's not fully conscious, and normally the nearest we get to it is some kind of dreaming, but it's just degrees of, and eventually as that kind of bubbles up to the surface, it becomes fully conscious. And so you know, I think a lot of our dreaming is a bit like the nearest this altered version of ourselves gets to reality, but it's not allowed access to the body, it's not allowed access to the eyes, to the senses. But if you push the boundaries really hard and that normal control breaks down, you get a really bizarre insight into what's going on in your own mind that normally you don't get. And you know, I think there's a whole vast sort of thing to explore in there that most of us in our culture have not really grown up with that idea, or it's been so rigid and regimented that we wouldn't really push the boundaries. And yet traditionally these kind of activities were much more normal. You know, people were spending God knows what time and effort to get out of their normal mind.
Right. Well, well, I mean, it sounds like you've got tons of obviously interesting theories and experiences and whatnot. So before we get out of here, what are you working on now, or like what are some things you've done recently that people can check out? And if they do want to check out some of your stuff, or I know you have a book and some other things, where can they go?
Sure. Well, I self-published Left in the Dark in 2007, and it was republished as Return to the Brain of Eden in 2014, I think. And that was a culmination of research up till about 15 years ago, I guess. And yeah, initially I was quite happy with that, but having had a lot of time to think about it, and you know, what I'm working on now is a redistillation. I think there's a much, much less complicated way to say all of this. I mean, the reaction I get is pretty good, but there's not everybody gets the whole picture. There's a lot of pieces and they have to fit in a certain way. So the last couple of years I've been working on a much simpler approach, and you know, I'm getting close to where I'm going to be writing that up soon. So essentially I'm working on a new book that I hope will make the idea much more accessible. And then of course,
like a sleep deprivation for dummies type of book.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, I know that's a big part of your interest, and it's certainly been part of my research. But I guess it's a lot broader than just sleep deprivation.
Right, right,
it's,
right.
It's really looking at human origins, a collective state of mind, and essentially, one of the questions I'm asking is, well, why are we clinically insane, and is there anything we can do about it? So there's a serious element to it. It's not just,
right.
You know, it's not just, you know, the sleep and all the rest of it. Even though that can be great fun, and you know, so yeah, that's part of it. I think I do have a YouTube channel. I can never remember what it's called, but it's fairly easy to find if you just type my name in. So. Yeah, the book provides a good introduction, and there's some YouTube stuff, but I'm hoping to have a new book out. You know, pretty it takes a while to write these things. It'd probably be another 18 months or so, but that's what I'm working on at the minute anyway.
Awesome. Thanks so much for popping on. Very interesting stuff. I mean, I feel like we can go for hours here talking about different things and whatnot. So we'd love to have you back on sometime and talk about more, maybe some things outside of like the sleep deprivation and whatnot. But thanks for giving us a few minutes. It was awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. And for the record, his site, his YouTube videos, it's youtube.com/user/TonyWrightUK.
Interesting.
Yeah.
No. It's funny thinking like about the sleep thing. I remember having like sleepovers with my friends and being like, you know, pushing, let's pull an all nighter, man. I got my second wind. I got my third wind, and like out by like, you know, 3 in the morning. Like, could never get into the full all nighter. I don't know if I've done an all nighter. Probably at least once.
I think I once, when I was like really young, saw a horror movie and I was up for like 2 days straight.
Mm.
Then, I think I'd like just regular, hey, I'm going to stay up. I mean, college days, yeah.
One time I worked a, or either I worked a double or I was working a double the next, like when I was waitering. And we left on a Friday night, went down the AC, and came back for the Saturday morning shift at 10. So, wow. Yeah, it was pretty.
What was your work?
I was waitering in college at the time. So it was like we got off around like 11 o'clock on Friday night, shut down the AC, and we were up in Mahwah. So it took we got down there to 1:30.
Jeez.
Just like gambled and had a couple of drinks and came back. We were there for 10 o'clock. So stupid, but it was kind of fun at the time.
I'm sure you were in a great mood the next day.
Oh yeah, yeah. And then a couple people had to work like double shifts that day. It was awful. But let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. Okay, we are back.
We are.
I saw you went down to Citizens Bank this weekend.
Yes, I did. Did a little mini Burlew Week of Discovery over the weekend.
Burlew's Weekend of Discovery.
Yeah. We did a few things. We did a little tour of Philadelphia before the game.
I don't think it counts as Burlew's Week of Discovery when it's not just you wandering around, like going to like...
No.
It's yeah. Now you're like sharing with somebody.
Well, Izzy's just following me for the most part.
Get back here.
But we went to go see the Liberty Bell, and the line was huge. I mean,
yeah,
it was very long. I was kind of shocked by that. You figure something like that, it's like, all right, you walk in, you see it, you go on to your next thing. But it was a good like 30-minute thing to wait for it. So we did a horse carriage tour of Philadelphia.
That's cool.
That was cool. I mean, it's interesting, it's romantic, but at the same time, you can barely hear the person giving you the tour stuff. And just... yeah. What? And then Izzy'd be suddenly like, oh, that's fascinating. Well, what's fascinating? Oh, George Washington. What about George Washington? I don't know. She said George Washington.
Is he just saying, yeah, that's great. Yeah. What's great? I don't know what's great.
And just walking around, you could barely hear him. And then add to it, I mean, they don't have the right of way. So you're going through the streets with other cars and you're dealing with that and people are honking their horns. So it's
come on, horse.
And she, yeah, the girl was actually like mad at this one person. She's like, oh no, you ain't cutting off my Betsy or whatever the horse's name was.
Okay, so you did the horse tour.
Yeah,
that always reminds me of the Seinfeld episode where the horse is just farting.
Rusty,
oh!
He actually had his own like little basket and all just to do
poop
his
basket. Business. Yeah, yeah. Well, can't be pooping all over the city.
Well, it's Philly.
Bums do. I mean, all right.
We actually passed by Patty's Pub. I wanted to go back, but we didn't have time for that.
Max Bar or whatever it is? Max.
Well, we weren't by Max's actual bar, but we passed the place that is listed as Patty's Pub.
Oh, right, nice. There.
So then we went to the game, which was super awesome. That was a game the Phillies scored 12 runs in the first inning.
12 in the first
inning. It was just insane. I mean, we started off the game just like, I don't know, it's Washington. They're going to whoop our butt. Nola's first start since basically he has a tear in his... what's the one where you get Tommy John in? I only know pancreas is not tendon. The UCL, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, UCL's in the arm, but rotator cuff is a big one. And then Tommy John is the... I don't know. Keep going.
Yeah, but... Yeah, it was like his first official start, and then like he loaded the bases with one out, and we lucked out. They hit into a double play. It's like, oh man, I don't know how long he's going to last. We really need to get some runs. And then they just, that poor Guthrie guy, man, he's already lost his job, so his career is pretty much over. But gave up
good.
Yeah, he gave up like 10 runs and 2/3 of an inning. Then the next guy came in, and they were still bashing the ball on him. So
yeah. Dude, the Mets are playing the Phillies as we speak. I don't want to know the score. I'm recording it. But all the Phillies look alike. There's like four Phillies that I was watching. So they all have like
dreads like just past her ears or like braids mm-hmm. down past her ears. They're like dark skin. They're either like Spanish or black. But there's like four of them. I'm like, is that Odubel Herrera? Is that blah, blah, blah? And I'm like,
Freddie Galvin.
Freddie Galvin. Yeah, a lot of them. And they have like similar like height.
Mikhail Franco.
Yeah. There's a lot of them that look alike. I'm not saying they all look alike, people.
That should be the name of the episode. Y'all look alike.
But
and you can't sleep.
Did you come home after that? Or?
Yeah, we left around the seventh inning just because the dog was home. It's like, all right, this is official. Like
it's not close either.
Like the Nationals had like a little bit of rally. They scored like two runs. I'm like, all right, I don't normally leave early, but if it stays this at the seventh inning, we'll go. And then we got like in our three runs after. I said, all right, I'm fairly confident they can't screw up this one.
That's like Saturday. I went to the Devils game to see Patrick Elias. He didn't even play. He just did like, he warmed up with the team, let him drop the puck and skate around and said bye. But the Devils are so bad that me and my buddy Alex, like the third period, were just like walking around the stadium, just like kind of hanging out. Like, we're like, this is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But,
And then the next day we went out to look at waterfalls.
Yay! Mm. Any particular waterfall?
Where did we go? I would have to
go chasing waterfalls.
We brought the dog with us, and there was a kind of a cute moment. There was a little girl. She was like a special needs girl, and she saw Callie in her heart. She's like, oh, doggy. And she was so happy, and she was petting Callie and giving her kisses. It was a sweet moment, you know.
Way to warm the cockles of everyone's heart on the podcast here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The pancreas controls cockles. As
and the emotions.
Yeah. But that was sweet. We went to, like, two of them, and then we went to, like, a winery. And then we ended our day, and then I went to work, and I hated life, and I'm here.
I'm sure you have pictures to document the whole weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're
flip,
out there.
Flip book.
Mm.
There's Berlew drinking wine, but I don't know if you caught on. You read this, but I was talking about the baseball because Noah Syndergaard is just becoming my favorite athlete ever.
I saw your post.
I don't know if you read the article, but he's having this ongoing feud with Mr. Mitt and all mascots apparently now too.
Yeah, he took the Philly Fanatic ATV last night.
He stole the ATV, and the Philly Fanatic's like running after him. Noah's just like cruising around, but there's this feud going on between him and Mr. Mitt, and it's really funny. He's like Mr. Mitt would tweet at him like, looking for a Valentine's date? I know a guy, and it's like, let's see. It's a picture of Mr. Mitt and Noah Syndergaard's like old doofy fat picture from when he was like in middle school. And then Noah tweets back, Mr. Mitt, I have plans with someone tonight. Pretty sure you know her. And it's a picture of him and Mrs. Mitt. And then they keep going back and forth. Noah Syndergaard says, dude, please tell your mom I said hi. And then like they just keep going back and forth. It's awesome. He's like, just picked up Noah's birthday cake. It's like, can't wait to surprise him. It's his happy birthday, Snydergaard.
Oh, okay.
But it's just, apparently it's been going on for quite a while now. I like this one. He goes, where is it? Thanks for the early Christmas present, Mrs. Mitt. And it's a pair of Mitt's underwear. Like he's plowing Mrs. Mitt. It's pretty. It's pretty great, but I'd like to see this. Like, you know.
Well, if he has a feud against every mascot, all right. So you got Mr. Mitt. You got the Philly Fanatic. I mean, looking Bernie Brewer. Does he like just push him aside and go down and
throw him down the slide head first?
Yeah. Billy the Marlin.
Yeah, I'm interested to see like. If he continues like to go after other mascots like throughout the year, like is he going to be like followed, or is this just going to be like a one time thing, or is he just going to keep it going with Mr. Mitt?
I'm trying to even find Mariner Moose.
Mariner Moose, yep.
I mean, does San Diego Chicken still occur? Is he still around?
I don't know. Maybe he passed on.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Is that really Wally the Green Monster?
Mm-hmm. Wally.
I think that's about it. Apparently the Nationals have Screech.
Oh, yeah, he's an eagle.
Yeah, and the Royals have Slugger.
he's a lion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Yankees have that homeless guy that bangs pots and pans.
Yeah, that's Alex Rodriguez. He really didn't invest that money too well.
But, they had a guy that used to come around and just bang pots and pans together. That was their mascot for a while. But it's 7:27.
Yeah. You know what that means.
Yeah, We got a guest.
We are the best because that's our guest. We'll put that on the next set of t-shirts.
All down the back.
Yeah. Hey, weirdness.
But this was another Berlew find here.
Mm-hmm.
This one's interesting, too. So why don't you introduce, let's get the names here.
Yeah, let me bring them up.
Bring them up. We got a guest.
I don't know who, but we got a guest.
gotta get it off my chest.
Yeah, we're gonna be talking with Catherine King and Wayne Adams.
Oh, you know, like that pop band.
Yeah. King and the Adams.
I love their duos.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Their 80s music just rocked me every night. But in all seriousness, they are the proprietors of Freedom Cove, which is a man-made island in Vancouver, Canada, that was built by the two of them where they've been living for the last 20 years.
Yeah. So we're going from the United Kingdom. And then we're going over to
literally the other side of Canada.
Canada.
Yeah. I hope this works. They basically said, yeah, the internet guy was here yesterday, so this should be good.
Well, let's find out. Well, at least we get to listen to the cool Skype song. Hello.
Hi.
Hey. we had some crazy sounds just come through here. I don't know if it's the connection or whatnot, but it literally almost blew our eardrums out.
Right.
So you guys are in British Columbia, correct?
Yeah, we are. We're on the northwest coast of Vancouver Island.
Yeah, okay, and you're on your own island, I guess you would call that?
Yeah, we have created our own floating world here, all from recycled materials.
Now, when on earth did you get this idea?
Well, we started this project 25 years ago. And we're both artists, and we were living in a nearby town. And a storm came up and threw all this lumber all over the bay, and I picked it up. The man who owned it said to me, I can have it. So that's what started the floating studio, and then over the last 25 years, it's evolved to what it is now.
When you first had an idea for this, what was the natural thought? It was just actually build an island? I'm guessing you don't have experience building an island before, but how does that come about, the idea?
Well, you know, I've always been a model maker, and I've always made things from used materials. And what's happened on the coast here is the fish farm industry and technology started to grow. And what you see here on this floating island is I've really recycled the fish farm. It's sort of like a giant Meccano set to me. And I've always been building and making models since I was a little guy.
Now, this island, okay, what is keeping it afloat? What is the base of the island? Is it all wood?
It's all metal now, except for our house.
Okay.
And it's styrofoam, armored styrofoam float.
It's old. It's recycled old fish farm systems.
It's just like, it's hard to imagine the start. Like, looking at the pictures, I could see, like, what it became. Like, if we were looking at, like, an aerial view of the island, where did this start? Was it, like, just a small house? Was it, you said the studio? How big are we talking here?
Yes, when we first started, we started with the house. We had a friend who had a cabin in Cypress Bay, which is the big bay that our cove is connected to. and a storm actually blew in all the wood that started the house. We were staying at that cabin to explore the area because we knew we wanted to live out. And fortuitously, this wood presented itself. We gathered it up and took it to the fellow we thought it belonged to. And he said, "You gathered it up, it's yours." So Wayne did the building of the house on the beach, which was about a three-month period before it was built enough that we could start moving into it. And then we had it towed over to the cove. So it was just a house with a log in front that we started with.
Now, with this island, are you... How does this work as far as, like, owning it? Like, do you just float around? Are you anchored to something? Do you have to pay to... I don't even know what to say. To pay to dock the island? Like, how does... Were you paying taxes as a colony or a boat? Like, what? How does this work?
It's all floating. And I have a science background, so it's applied science. But what it is I have long ropes tied to shore with anchors on those ropes.
Uh-huh.
So the system moves. I'm floating about a million pounds, 500 tons. And it moves around in the storm. It goes up and down with the tide. I built it to move. And we do get storm and hurricane force winds here.
And we pay two taxes to be here. That's what makes it legal for us to be here. When we moved here 25 years ago, this was considered a multi-use corridor, and there weren't the same issues at that time as there are now. We've been paying a municipal tax for 13, 14 years, and we've been paying a provincial tax for about 4 years now.
Interesting. Well, how long did it take for you to want to, like, expand it or whatever? And what basically pushed you to go this route? Were you just sick of the city life or just enjoyed nature? What exactly drove you into that realm?
Well, for me, the most important thing is I've been coming here for 40-plus years into Clackamas Sound, and there's a lot of artists here and a lot of carvers. First Nations here carving is a tradition. Been carving for 45 years. So I live in nature. I'm inspired by being out here. And I have life skills growing up with it and old school. So the best part about being here is the people that can understand what I'm doing. And they all have the same attitude towards life here. It's learned by doing. And most people here are in touch with nature. There's not a big population here because it's not an easy thing to do. But I got a background, and I traveled when I was young. I went to Australia when I was a boy, and the Aussie taught me how to survive in the wilderness. So when I came back to Canada, I went into sciences, and I was a ranger in my life. So I've got a big background and been out there and done a lot of things to be able to do this.
No.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the same for me. I've done a lot of things before coming here, and we both spent time in nature in our childhood and are both inspired by nature. And so that was the impetus to want to come out here and do this. And you asked about how did it start to expand. Well, I knew that I wanted to grow my own garden and have organic food to eat from.
Right.
So as my garden expanded, the whole system expanded.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. The pictures show an amazing-looking garden. Pretty much, it looks like it spans the whole island, kind of goes around it. Now, did that start as a small little couple plants in pots and keep going? Are you guys completely self-sufficient on the island?
I tell everyone that comes, it just started as a little salad garden, honey.
And yes, so I started small, and then as I could see how the plants were going to adapt to the climate here, I learned and I kept my garden growing. We eat all our own vegetables from the garden. I'm able to grow my garden all year round. And in the spring and summer seasons, I have fruits and berries as well as the vegetables. And I have herbs and edible flowers and decorative plants as well.
Hmm. Now, how much time do you spend at your home, considering it's out in the wilderness? Is it mostly, do you just literally do your artwork there, or is there a lot of times where you have to go into the city?
No, this is it. This is our life. We live out here 24/7.
And you, no, neither of you have ever thought to throw the other one off the island in an argument.
Yeah. Oh, a wilderness with a woman.
So you never go into town like to see, I don't know, to see a band play or hear music or talk to other people. It's just everything's on the island.
Well, every couple of weeks we go into Tofino to get staple sort of supplies.
Oh, okay.
In the winter, it can go longer if there are storms preventing us from going in. And we basically go in and run around and get the things that we have to get, say hi to a few people very quickly, and come back out. When you live this way, the longer you live out, the more you don't want to go in.
Right.
And, yeah, that's the truth of it.
I need chocolate.
No. I'm just thinking like, now do you, obviously, people have found out about your island or know about your island, because otherwise we would have never found you. But do you take people aboard down to show them how you live, or is it just pretty much like, stay out, or do you like welcome people to come check out what you guys did?
No, we welcome people. That is why you do know about us. And we have tours that come out to see our place from June until September.
Oh, cool.
Mostly. People come at other times as well, but that's the fair weather time when people like to come. And we like to have people come out because we want to inspire people to follow their own dreams, whatever they are.
As I was looking at the site where I found you, was from Browning Pass Charters. They show pictures here of bears and wolves and items like that. Is that an item that you have to deal with a lot of times? Or, I mean, obviously you're on an island, but do you see a lot of wilderness coming up to your house?
Yes, it's about a 10-mile trip. At Browning Passage, well, he has a cruise, and we're part of that, which is a lot of fun, and we're a big surprise when people come and have a visit with us.
Yeah, but he asked, do we have wilderness?
Yeah. Oh, we have everything here, bears, whales, you name it.
Whales?
Wolves. Yeah, this is a big whale-watching area where we are.
So, like, where I live, like, when there's a rabbit in my garden, I chase it out. Are you ever like, get out of here, whale!
Friendly with everything.
Stop nibbling on my carrots, orca. But go ahead.
We do have mice that swim over to the float, believe it or not, swim and
really?
Dive. So I'm a softie, so I live trap the mice, paddle them out somewhere else, and let them go. All the other wildlife really doesn't bother what we're doing here. We're really careful not to put meat smells out to draw them over. We do have wilderness moments and stories about bears, and even a cougar story.
Well,
so we have had some exciting.
You can't hold back on us. Like, yeah. We even have a segment on the show called Bear News. Which I find bear stories, and I talk about them, you know, because I'm fascinated by bears. So, you are in charge of bear news. You got to tell us a bear story.
We're talking about bear and shit. We're talking about bear and shit. It's freaking bear news. Bears in the world doing all sorts of things. Yeah, girl.
Two good bears.
Stop nagging me. I'm thinking about the Bears.
I tell everyone I have a few stories. I need to go back. One of them goes back a bit. I've been everywhere in British Columbia as a ranger. I've cruised all of BC and been in all the timber you can imagine. I've met pretty much everything out there. And I always had a summer student with me and fresh troops out there. And so, I mean, you're cruising in the bush, you chain through it. And we came across a sleeping bear, and I didn't see him. So as I walked, my summer student was behind me about a good 100 yards. So then a bear wound up between me and him.
Jeez.
So they're coming, so I turned around, and I saw a bear chasing him. And summer student was coming after me.
Wow.
So I just took off. And he was in full stride, and he never passed me. He was a young kid. Anyways, I turned around as I was going downhill. I went toe-to-toe and went straight up a tree. And I turned around and looked around, and there was no bear, no summer student or anything. No noise or nothing. So I yelled out, and my summer student called back, and I said he had to jump off of the cliff edge, and the bear followed him.
Whoa.
So I said to him, I said, where are you? And he says, keep talking. The bear's coming to you. So I talked to me. The bear came up the tree after me.
Jeez.
So when he got close, but I had a branch I broke off. When he got really close to me, I whacked him on the nose. And I turned around and walked down the ground and meandered away. But from that day on, all the crews out there, I was known for leaving my summer student as bait.
And just imagine the story he tells when he goes home. Oh, my God. That's amazing.
So, you know, I've three times. I've been chased by bears more than once. I've met every British Columbia, you know, close.
Wow. Has a bear ever entered the island?
No, the beauty of this, the bears here are wild. They don't associate food with people.
Right.
That's how far out we are. So I've always paid attention to that. Being wildlife myself, I've worked with animals, so I'm very conscious about not attracting them.
Right.
And we're 25 years and never had a bear problem.
We have bears walk all around us on low tide. We have a beach in the cove, and you'll see them walking all around, and they're close to us, but they have never tried to come over, so we feel really good about the rapport we have with them.
The beauty of floating.
Now, it's funny, when you mentioned low tide, has the tide ever got so low where the island sits on the bottom, or has it never gotten that low?
Yeah, no, there are extreme tides where the house will, but the island's still in 4 feet of water. We're just tucked right under the cove so we get good weather.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah, Wayne designed the house so it could sit on the beach and then come back up with the tide, so it works well.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. What were you going to say?
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm listening to this. I hear about how you made your own home. You're both artists. You're around with nature. It your whole life sounds amazing to me. When people do these tours and they come around, do you laugh at people who say they work in a cubicle for 8 hours a day? I guess
I like working alone. I like working. Jeez.
Well, laugh at the people. Let me see now.
Yeah. We have some standard things that people ask us. A lot of them, you know, pretty much standard. But it's always fun because we built this and went this far to share it with the children and our families. Our grandchildren being raised in Sweden, and we've had all our families and friends come and to help them get away from the big city and their life, and enjoy fishing with me and being real. But it was really to inspire the kids and the family. And now, because we've been a long time, the tourist industry is built up in Clackwood, not so much resource hunting. And so we've always had a door, open door for people to come and share what we've done.
It's awesome. Now, let me ask you something. You're both artists, sculptors, carvers. I don't think that ever leaves you. So what kind of art are you guys still doing? And Catherine, it says you're a retired ballerina. Do you still ever you know, are you doing pliés and pirouettes still, or what's going on there?
Yes, I am. In fact, I have a dance floor here. That was after we got the house and the log, before the garden, the next thing was the dance floor. So I'd have a place to move. And every day, and had to have that as part of my lifestyle. It would have been too hard to not be able to plie every day.
That's my job. I tell the young men, if you're going to take a pretty lady out into the wilderness, you've got to do more than throw her under a blue tarp.
Words to live by.
I feel like a lot of first dates out there, that's how that happens.
Yeah. You know? So many times I've lost a lady because I threw a tarp on her. Little did I know.
See, I always thought you lost the lady, then threw the blue tarp on
her. Well, we're not talking about that. Yeah. I gotta ask you, I mean, even when I saw the video of your island and I wanted to get in touch with it, see if we can get a podcast, I kind of said, okay, that's a low ball chance of getting considering where you're at. How the heck did they get internet service down to you to do the Skype interview, out of curiosity?
There's like an antenna on an orca somewhere. There's a whale swimming around the property with a modem on his head.
That's right. That's right. We have a trained whale. Well, let's see. It was 2012, and due to the fact that there are fish farms in the area and there is an elite wilderness resort that was requiring internet, that's how it became out. So we lucked out and got on board after, at that point, let's see, it was 21 years without any external type of contact other than our radio in the boat.
I mean, it truly is amazing what you do. And it's awesome that, like, you're still allowed to do this. Like, you're still, you know, you have this massive island. Actually, how big is it, first off, like, total?
How big?
Oh, it's, like, about 2 feet lots. Something like that.
I'm sorry. Say that one more time. We have the connection's a little tough here.
About the size of 2 city lots.
Oh, wow. Nice. Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to tell just how big it is from the picture. So, one, it's amazing what you guys do. And it's amazing that, like I said, you're still allowed to do it in this day and age. And you hope that you'll always be able to, you know, kind of keep this thing going. But, like, what would you say for people who may want to visit, okay, or may want to check you out? What is, like, your overall message or goal? Obviously, you live there, so you're enjoying your life. But you also mentioned something about inspiring people and whatnot. So what is your overall message with the place?
Well, there's a few things. For me, simply, just learn by doing and choose your teachers, man. If I can show you what I've done and it inspires you in any way to do your own thing, it's an honor to be part of that.
Yeah, it's same for me, and really encouraging people to think creatively, to really know that they can accomplish their dream, whatever it is. They just have to focus their thought force there and do the work involved.
I guess one more question I have is, if I'm not sure if you keep up with everything that's been going on with America, but if you do, have you thought about cutting the lines and pushing that island a few more miles away from the U.S. border?
Actually, I'm finding it entertaining. We have a lot of friends down there, and to tell you the truth, I got more problems in Canada
than
down there.
All right.
Interesting.
Well, we could save that for another time. But Wayne, Catherine, thank you guys both so much for coming on. Even with the rough connection, it's really amazing to think about where us talking through this microphone is traveling through the information superhighway down to a narwhal's head into your computer. But no, it really is amazing to see what you could find and the people we get to talk to doing this. And thanks for giving us a few minutes.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's an honor.
It's been very enjoyable.
Thanks so much, and good luck with the island, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye. Wow. Yeah, it's a shame that the connection's, like, you know, it's so hard, but because it was really fascinating. Like, just, like, amazing. Like, we're talking to someone in the middle of a, I guess it's, what is it, a river? Or is it, I don't know, a Freedom Cult. You know, they're floating around right now, like, in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
They're talking to us. But should you live on an island?
I would love the chance, but knowing my abilities around, like, a weekend, it's like, yeah, I got to go back to land.
I just picture, like a documentary crew, like, lining up to film you on the island, and then, like, 2 days in, the island sinking, you know, and you're just, like, waving the white flag on a burning pyre. Like, oops.
Cement doesn't float, guys. I made a mistake.
I can't imagine there's, like, a high demand of IT work on the island, on islands.
Why is there a database on this island? This is my, you're fishing. What the hell?
But, yeah. Pretty amazing.
You need guests tonight.
Yeah, that is 100% accurate. Completely unique. I don't really have much. I'm going away tomorrow. I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm going to Vermont for a few nights.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Where parts?
We are going to wake up probably around 5:30. It depends if Alex ever packs. She just gave me the death look. Oh, and now she's air. Never mind. She gave me the death look. And
we open up the luggage. It's like the biggest variations of different things. There's like a whisk in there.
In case we need to make pancakes. They got the syrup,
but I forgot all my clothes. We are going near Stowe, which is like the mountain up there. Okay. We were going to go snowboarding, but we kind of nixed it. It's still open, technically, but we're just going to do like some breweries and some hiking. We're taking Obi with us. We're staying in a little cabin. Going 3 nights, and just going to enjoy ourselves.
All right. The chill, not the... That's what I kind of like. I don't need official plans. I just need options.
Yeah, I mean, it's like there's a million things to do. I'm sure there's little shops and restaurants and things, and it's not just relax. Oh, thanks, Elby.
There's barking.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll get us kicked out of there quickly. But yeah, it should be fun. Looking forward to get away for a few days. And then good old Easter on Sunday, my favorite holiday, Zombie Jesus Day. But
I can't remember one big Easter moment.
I know, like a defining Easter moment.
I found the egg.
I remember one thing I did love, my uncle, before he, when he was married and before he had, he's the one in the nursing home permanently, but they used to do like adult, like Easter egg hunts and like really high. There wasn't an eggs. It was they put like $20 bills in like really hard to find spots, and their whole house was up for grabs. Like, and you had to really go like look for things. And I remember that being really cool because like when you got a certain age, we were allowed to participate in like the adult one and try to find money. And then they also did a good job of like you would have to find your eggs for the kids. And there'd be little clues on where to go get your basket. So you'd have to find like 9 different eggs. So Berlu's eggs would be like orange. And any orange egg you find would be like the next clue, the next clue, the next clue to where your like basket was, which was pretty cool.
I got a feeling when they moved out of the house, somebody found like 20 eggs worth like $3,000.
Yeah. I don't know. I think $20 was like the big one back then. So I don't know. That was, speaking of that, I went to cash. My mom found 2 savings bonds I have. Okay. These things are just the stupidest things in the world.
It's don't get it.
A $75 one and a $100 one.
I'm going to say, right over here. Oh, I may have lost the money.
Hence why they're so stupid.
Yeah. Oh, here.
Dumb bonds.
So a $75 one, right?
Uh-huh.
And let's see if it says the year it was bought. It doesn't say the year it was bought, but these have to be from when I was a child, you know. The $75 one is worth $53.70, which makes sense. It's like another like 15 years or something.
Yeah.
And then the $100 one is worth $71.81. Because I went to the bank and I was like, oh, I'm just going to cash these in and use it for the trip or whatever. You know,
$150
gas money.
Obviously. It's on the thing.
And then it's like, I don't want to cash them in before they mature. But then even when they mature, it's like, ooh, it's going to be $100 after like 20 years.
Yeah.
What a weird... weird present.
I don't know. Stupid old people making bonds.
Yeah, what? I don't know about bonds, but
yeah.
I got nothing else, brother. What do you got? Anything?
I'm trying to think. I guess as addition to bear news, did you see how we can now hunt hibernating bears now?
Yeah, and I also heard that there's something where we could hunt from helicopters or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's great. It's the Sarah Palin rule.
Oh, good, good.
Hey, you know, that makes you really... have to work to get the animal.
First off, there's nothing more manly than killing an animal with a high-powered weapon from long distances in a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's naturally what they face in nature, you know. Because, you know, hawks and stuff are equivalent to a helicopter with a gun on the end of it.
You realize that bears get intelligent. We're like the Decepticons to them. We're just the foreign... element that comes in and destroys them, and it's like, no! And then you need, like, the lead bear to come up with a plan to destroy us. I just realized my powerful claws kill them all.
It's pretty sad.
I'm still working on the plot, you know.
Gotcha. Yeah, it needs a little writing.
Yeah, a little bit. Well,
a little punch up, as they say.
I think those two items are enough to make it a movie.
Mm-mm. But anyway, let's get out of here. Anything to promote?
Anything to promote? I guess I
Tomote. I like to tomote things. I tomote all the fun things in my life. I like to talk to people on an island while I tomote all my favorite things, pancreas.
That's a beautiful ending to the song. I just want to tell you
that. Thank you. Thank you.
I guess from former guests, I'll promote Sabretti's Hot Dogs.
Oh, yes.
We were there two times for Randy Santel, Rohan Shetty, who runs the place, who owns it. He's a great person. They still have the hot dog challenge there, and they come out with different brands and unique items such as rattlesnake hot dogs and items like that. So if you like a good hot dog and you're in Hong Kong area, go to 22 Lakeside Boulevard in Hong Kong, New Jersey.
How did I ever let you do radio where pronouncing things is like a... Hot Kong.
I was trying to.
I love to tomote Hot Kong.
Hop at Kong.
He just went through something where, like, he was fighting the man, like, you know, like something to do with taxes and credit charges. Sobretti's was on the news recently.
Really?
Yeah. It's funny. I thought that's what you were going to say, but then it was just about their hot dogs.
Pretty much.
Coincidence.
Who goes in there for tax advice?
No, I think they were fighting like some big company, some big corporate company or something. I don't know. You got to look it up. But I'm going to promote... I guess we'll do Tap House 15.
Why not?
Tap House 15. Why not? No, you don't say. But I'm going to promote...
Continue with your statements about Tap House 15, Scotland.
April 27th, Tap House 15. There's a couple seats left. Seymour Swan headlining, Jeffrey Paul, Sean Martin, and Joan Weisblatt. And we're raising some money for a friend of mine. He is a coach of a Special Olympics basketball team.
Oh, cool.
So we're going to raise some money for that cause. So come on out. It's always a fun night. Now, before we get out of here, guys, there's a couple things you can do for us. If you enjoyed what you heard, the best thing you can do is share it with someone. Post it. Say, hey, I love this. This was cool. Sleep deprivation. Island people. Check it out. That would be great for us. The other thing you can do is subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Laughable app. Basically anywhere you can get it. I mean, if you have a Google, you can pretty much find us.
Do I have a Google?
Yeah, you have a Google. All right.
Yeah.
But listen, go back a couple episodes, some of the people we talked to. Victor Wooten, bass player last week. Before that, a professional wake surfer. The episode before that was Bab
Bob Rathbone of the Atlantic Hawks and Ben Brown, professional kayaker. Before that was Abby the Astronaut, who is getting all sorts of headlines. And before that was the Miller brothers from UFC. Before that was Zoltan Esteban and Stephen LeBou, professional cliff diver. So there's lots of episodes. Every episode is something interesting or unique like this.
Next week, not any different.
Yeah, next week should be good. And we're pretty much booked for the next 3 or 4 weeks. So with that, let's get out of here. Let's see.
Any pancreas songs to go out on?
I am the pancreas. But
now you intrigue me.
I am the pancreas. But life is funny, people. Laugh at it. Keep doing it at your back. Bye-bye.